It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a series of new studies digs into Facebook and its influence on political polarization. A Wisconsin expert tells us what went into the study and what we've learned so far. Christopher Nolan's new movie Oppenheimer has been a box office success, raking in more than $400 million in its first 10 days. For context, that's more than his movie Batman Begins made in its entire theater run. The film follows the story of J. Robert Oppenheimer, the scientist who directed the Los Alamos Laboratory for the Manhattan Project during World War II, who later became known as the father of the atomic bomb.
At a moment where it looked like the chain reaction from an atomic device might never stop.
Are we saying there's a chance that when we push that button, we destroy the world?
Chances are near zero.
Near zero.
What do you want for theory alone?
Zero would be nice.
As General Leslie Groves, played by Matt Damon, talking to J. Robert Oppenheimer, played by Cillian Murphy, shortly before the first testing of the atomic bomb in southern New Mexico in July of 1945. The film has generated renewed interest in the history of nuclear weapons and the moral questions surrounding their creation and use as the world approaches the 78th anniversary of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki on August 6th and August 9th, 1945. You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you gone to see the new Oppenheimer movie? What did you think? Do you have questions for our guest about what the film gets right or wrong about the Manhattan Project and how the atomic bomb was created? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Alex Wellerstein is a historian of science and nuclear technology. He's a professor at the Stevens Institute of Technology and author of the book Restricted Data, The History of Nuclear Secrecy in the United States. Alex, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm really pleased to be here. Thank you.
You've seen the movie a couple times now, I understand. First of all, when it comes to using this movie as a conversation starter, a teachable moment, what do you think the movie gets right that people could pursue in more depth?
There's a lot that it gets right. I mean, there's a lot of attention to detail. I will say the thing that I'm most impressed by, as somebody who spent a lot of time thinking about Oppenheimer, they get an aspect of Oppenheimer's personality right that's very easy to get wrong. He is not some sort of everyman. He is also not some kind of inspirational science figure. He's a very complex, somewhat troubled, somewhat insecure guy from the beginning. And I'm really appreciative of them getting that right, because I think the temptation is to turn him into some kind of hero or martyr, and they do something more complicated with him, and I really like that.
Give us a quick introduction for people not familiar with Oppenheimer. Who was he as a person at this pivotal moment in the history of our species, really?
Oppenheimer is a person who sort of at his core is trying to be this very... He wants you to be impressed by him. That's clear from very early on. He wants to belong. He wants to be you to be impressed by him. But he also simultaneously sort of wants to go his own way. And these internal conflicts, this is kind of what guide him through a lot of his life. And it's one of the ways in which this guy who is really not your stereotypical military scientist ends up running this weapons project and building this weapon, which he himself is sort of building it in part because he wants to ban them from the world. And like, these are the paradoxes of this guy, and also why when you hold him up to a microscope, as they do in the 50s, because he has questions about his whether he deserves a security clearance, he doesn't fit the mold in a really stereotypical way, and, you know, can't really hack it in a sort of later Cold War environment.
One critique you've brought up elsewhere, I grew up with this argument or this understanding of the use of the first nuclear weapons dropped in wartime, and only nuclear weapons so far dropped in wartime, that there was this very careful strategic consideration at the highest levels of American government that said, yes, we're going to use this weapon. Yeah, maybe it's a horrible weapon, but it's going to prevent the United States from having to invade mainland Japan to end World War II. We're making this calculation and it's worth it. And you say the recent scholarship doesn't really back up that understanding. Can you flesh that out for us?
There's been a lot of work over the last, let's say, 20 to 30 years where historians who are not quite in that old Cold War debate mode have sort of looked at this with fresh eyes. And what they find is that that whole narrative, this what we might call the decision narrative, which sets it out as you had to sort of, the idea is that this was very deeply considered and the long-term implications were deeply considered, and yet it was the best of all possible outcomes, and it was sad that we had to do it, but we had to do it. It doesn't match what the people in 1945 were actually thinking, who were in charge of this decision. It was a more chaotic sort of process. They didn't know the future. How could they? I mean, none of this by itself ought to be surprising. But the idea was, well, we'll just try everything. We have a bomb. Of course, we're going to use a bomb. They're not that concerned about Japanese civilians. They don't see it as some big trade-off. They think, oh, yeah, maybe it'll end the war early. Maybe the Soviet Union entering will end the war early. Maybe if we threaten them in the right way, they'll end the war early. We'll try everything because we don't really want to fight this war any further. It's not some sort of difficult moral dilemma. And the decision-making process is much more decentralized. There's people in the military making certain decisions. Some of the decisions that seem so fateful to us now, like dropping the second one when they do, that's done by people on the island of Tinian who are doing this because the weather forecasts. And none of this is to say that this means you can't support the use of the bombs or you should oppose them, but this rational version of it, this one that makes it sound like it's the product of a lot of strategic and logic, you know, political, philosophical, almost ethical thinking, that was invented after the fact because people were starting to criticize it in the 1940s. And so coming up with this sort of way of thinking about it, it's a very persuasive way. If you go down that logical path of the decision narrative, you think, well, they got it, probably had to use it. But that's why they invented it. It's not actually what people were thinking because they were human. They couldn't see the future. They weren't thinking about all of the things that you might later think about.
Talking to Alex Wellerstein, historian of nuclear technology, looking at the development and use of atomic weapons and the new movie Oppenheimer. You could join in with your questions, your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Alex, it does seem some people, including Oppenheimer, were thinking about the future. As you mentioned, Oppenheimer already thinking about banning these weapons he was developing. How big a split was there between people who viewed this new atomic bomb as, hey, a big weapon, but just another part of our arsenal, versus who saw it as a potentially world-changing technology that would change international relations and war maybe forever?
That's a super interesting question. It's interesting because at the time they're making this, there is a split. There are some people who see this as, this is going to change everything. This is going to remake the entire way the world has to operate. And then there are people who saw it as, hey, we have a very efficient way of burning cities. We already knew how to burn cities. We've been dropping napalm on cities, but normally it takes 500 planes. Now it only takes one plane. The interesting thing to me is that people have different stakes for wanting to subscribe to one of those approaches versus the other. So people who really think that this could be a vehicle for ending war in general, they really want to emphasize that this is a special weapon. That's the term they use. People whose relationship with the weapon is much more operational, like the people who are assembling the weapons on the island and actually dropping them out of planes, they often tend to see it as just another weapon. The military after the war, a lot of those high-ranking people emphasize that it's just another weapon because they didn't want conventional budgets cuts, right? They tried to sort of downplay it in a very deliberate way that later they didn't, because it turned out they didn't get their budgets cut. But this is, you know, how different is an atomic bomb? Is it different ethically or politically? This is an open subject for discussion. And it's an open subject for discussion even into the later 1940s. And to some degree, even today, there's versions of this debate that take place.
We're talking to science historian Alex Wellerstein from the Stevens Institute of Technology, looking at the making of the first atomic bomb, what the history can teach us today after the release of the new movie Oppenheimer. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you learn about the atomic bomb in your high school or college history classes? Has your view of this history changed over the years? Have you seen the movie? Does it raise questions for you? about the past, the present, or the future of nuclear weapons. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with nuclear historian Alex Wellerstein about the legacy of the atomic bomb after the successful release of the movie Oppenheimer, telling the story of the development of the first atomic weapons. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What thoughts, what questions, concerns do you have about nuclear weapons today? Have you seen the Oppenheimer movie? Do you have questions? If you're on hold right now, quick little blip in our phone lines, hang tight. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Alex, I want to fast forward to the present day. Now, when I grew up, and it turns out a lot of people around the country did this, we used to argue about, you know, why our community was likely to be targeted by Soviet nuclear weapons. Oh, we're near to, you know, auto plants and things like that. It seems like the consciousness of nuclear weapons has gone down a lot today, but they're still out there. Why has this faded so much in our minds?
It's pretty interesting the degree that is when the Cold War ended, there's sort of a collective cultural sigh in the United States, and people are sort of relegate nuclear weapons to this thing that was a threat then, but now we're beyond it, and so on and so on. And of course, the weapons didn't go away. They did change in their amount deployed and some of the approaches to them. But there have been also arms races relating to these weapons that people haven't really noticed. Like, they've become much more accurate. And there's things like trying to ballistic missile defenses, which changed the calculus a bit. It's been interesting for me to see, because every few years, something happens that thrusts them right back into the limelight very briefly, whether it's North Korea, whether it's Russia and Ukraine. And we have this intense conversation about them. And then they just sort of disappear again as we move on to something else. And then some other crisis moment comes up and we have this intense conversation and we have this whole, why haven't we talked about this? And then we go back to the status quo of not thinking about them. And it's a really different from, especially the later Cold War, like the 80s, where they were a much more persistent cultural feature. I wonder if that's going to shift. I mean, we've had a lot of these events in the last couple of years, especially with Russia and Ukraine, that have made these, you know, what used to be thought of as just Cold War issues like NATO feel very, very relevant. And the future of them seem very, very vibrant, for better or worse.
One place very aware of the nuclear weapon history, Japan. We've seen some of the studios involved in the movie sharing kind of zany memes with the Barbie movie coming out at the same time, but with nuclear weapon imagery as we get closer to the anniversary, as I mentioned, of the dropping of the nuclear weapons on Japan. What do you make of this online controversy where we're taking nuclear weapons pretty lightly, and it's a pretty serious topic?
It's a really complicated thing. The kitschy aspect of nuclear weapons is not new, or even the idea of the memes of them are not new, at least amongst Americans. The very first set of nuclear testing after World War II was called Operation Crossroads, and this was done at the Bikini Atoll, and this was a sort of sensation. And it's where we get the term for the bikini bathing suit, is from this set of nuclear tests. And this is like a year after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, to go from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, these horrible, horrible, tales of victims and things and the destruction, to haha, we've split the atom and the bikini is like a split atom because it's got two pieces. Like, this is I think this kind of paradox is at the core of American nuclear culture. It's the sort of thing that obviously the Japanese are not going to be pleased with. They have their own things, of course, that Americans find incomprehensible or even sometimes offensive, their own memes. I think that on the one hand, it's useful to remember, and I think the film tries to emphasize this in its way, that this is not a joke. These are really serious. We are not talking about even testing, which was itself not a joke and had consequences. On the other hand, it's not surprising that people today, in particular, they want to engage with this. They're not engaging with it through the actual lived experience of people who suffered from these weapons. They're engaging with it at some distance. And I think that that creates some of that opportunity for treating it very lightly, treating it very humorously.
You mentioned even in the testing, people were harmed. And this is a live issue today. People in New Mexico upset that the movie didn't talk about the damage that the initial atomic weapon testing program caused to people, a very real damage caused to people in New Mexico. Can you talk about that a little?
So the movie, not to defend it, but it's trying to do things almost exclusively through Oppenheimer's perspective. And this was not something he thought very much about or saw. So understandably, it wouldn't be something he would have encountered. But there are the Trinity test is a big part of the movie and the part of the Oppenheimer and World War II Manhattan Project story. And it created a significant amount of radioactivity. This radioactivity, it was carried by its mushroom cloud as it went into the upper atmosphere and moved through the general atmosphere. It was detectable at very, very far distances. Despite the Trinity site being relatively isolated and chosen for that, it was not entirely without people nearby, especially given the vast distances that these clouds could go. And so there are a significant number of people who received radiation doses of different strengths as a result. And the Manhattan Project personnel, they had people in towns nearby with radiation detectors watching the meters go up after the test. And they were supposed to, you know, evacuate the town if it went above a certain level. And none of the towns, in their judgment, went above that level, so they didn't do this. Today, we would have a much lower level for what would be an acceptable amount of radiation. This, they knew about the hazards of intense amounts of radiation, but the amount, the hazards from sort of chronic and low amounts were really not that well understood then, did not even become really that understood through the 50s and 60s. Today, we have set the bar for what's an acceptable exposure much lower than they would have had then. But this was something that they were sort of working out and essentially deciding that other people were going, that the benefit of making and testing this weapon outweighed potential harms to people downwind of it. And that's, you know, quite a decision to make without any kind of oversight, democratic process, et cetera. So it's a pretty troubling legacy of the development of these weapons in general.
Let's bring on a caller. Paul is with us in Milwaukee. Paul, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I heard your guest speak earlier of these kind of ideas of using of nuclear weapons, rather, as an open topic of conversation. And the question that came to my mind was where? Certainly not on NPR. It's certainly not on legacy media. We've got a group of people in Congress, a solidified legacy group on both the Republican and the Democratic side of the aisle, who are absolutely pro-war. In fact, there is no anti-war sentiment in the Congress. And yet hear the same arguments. When you said teachable moment, Rob, I thought of myself thinking, well, why not use it for the present? We are currently using much of that same language against the Russians. And the dehumanization that we used in order to justify dropping this bomb and incinerating thousands of people in Japan.
Paul, thanks for the call. Alex, do you see there being open forums for discussion? Paul doesn't.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Paul's making a very important distinction between like who talks about these things. And certainly NPR is not going to be advocating the use of nuclear weapons, thank goodness. And actually, your average people are not talking about this one way or the other most of the time. But there are people in the military, in the sort of defense complex, who do not see these weapons the same way that most average people do. They see them as potentially more usable, or they at least like to have options on the table. They see them in very like technical sense that often misses the broader context. And I think it's one of the dangers of there being this low public sort of salience, the fact that they're not part of our regular conversation. What that means is the people who get to dominate that conversation in policy tend to be the people who benefit the most from it. And this is not a conspiracy theory. This is like how lobbying works. This is how defense contractors work. And so one of my arguments for people should talk about this more and think about weapons more and get more politically involved with it more is because if you do not, the people who are going to be making those decisions are the people who benefit the most from either thinking about the weapons being more usable or having more of them. And I think that's a problem. I think that warps the policy conversation to a very small number of very interested people. So in a sense, I agree that this is kind of one of the issues that we're dealing with.
Let's take one more caller. Tom is with us in Spring Green. Tom, hi.
Hello, this is Tom. And I'm on my way home from Spring Green. And I remember in the days when there was a lot going on with nuclear, that they had a film that I saw about Rocky Flats where they had people on a lathe that were cutting nuclear triggers, which were the same magnitude as that of what was dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. A lot of these machinists were sick afterwards. And then actually my question is, could you talk about the relationship between Edward Teller and Oppenheimer?
Tom, I gotcha. Just a minute or so left, Alex. Quick thoughts on Edward Teller.
Let's do it all. Yeah, let's do it all. Well, Rocky Flats is fascinating. The production site that got shut down by the FBI and the EPA, if you don't know about it, that's incredible for a weapons production. Teller is so complicated. He gets turned into the villain. He is, in some ways, has terrible ideas. I have a little sympathy for Teller. I know that that's a heretical statement because he's not, I don't think he's like inherently an odious person. Whereas Louis Strauss, who plays a big part in the Oppenheimer movie, I thought they got across very well my impressions that I got from reading his memoirs and memos. Louis Strauss feels just all the way rotten to the core. Teller had strong opinions and he expressed them poorly and he suffered for it. He's not the best guy, but he's also not like an evil person. Strauss, I don't know. The jury's out.
Thanks for that call. And Alex, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. This is fun.
That was Alex Wallerstein, nuclear historian and professor at the Stevens Institute of Technology. He joined us to talk about the new Oppenheimer movie and the history of the atomic bomb and ongoing debates over nuclear weapons to this day. Coming up after the news, does Facebook have a big influence on political opinions here in the United States? We'll look at some new research on the topic. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about jerks at work and how to tell if you're one of them. Now, a new group of scientific studies says Facebook's algorithms can amplify political news, but stop short of outright affecting political polarization. Our next guest has been studying political polarization in Wisconsin and how it fits into media and social media, and he played a unique role in this new research on Facebook. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you talk politics over Facebook or maybe Instagram? Do you see a lot of political messages popping up? And how about back in 2020, the presidential election? What did you see there? Do you think it maybe changed people's minds? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mike Wagner is a professor of journalism and mass communication at UW-Madison. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here, Rob.
Before we get into the results of this study, you have a really unique vantage point. You played a special role. Can you talk about the research and then where you came in?
Sure. So the research is 17 academics at universities around the country partnering with social science researchers who work at Meta, which we used to call Facebook, and they partnered together to study the 2020 U.S. election with a variety of papers that they're writing, some of which are now out and published, which is why this has all been in the news. And they've been working on this since the spring of 2020. And since that time, I have been the project rapporteur, which is the fancy name they gave to the person who is watching, observing, taking notes, about all of these meetings. So I'm observing the meetings between the meta researchers and the academic researchers to see if, one, meta is kind of getting researchers to do things they wouldn't normally do to make meta look good. Two, to see if this kind of collaborative thing could be a model for future research between academics and social media platforms. And three, to talk about the process, some of the strengths and weaknesses of doing really high-level social science research in this way, which partners with social media companies, which lots of people don't trust.
And this has been tough research to do for people for a long time because you kind of, I think a lot of researchers have been working with whatever scraps they can glean online because Facebook and these other social media companies, they're businesses, they don't want to release their stuff. This study gets at some of it. You wrote up a thing on this saying, yes, we got pretty good research on this, but this may not be a model for good research in the future. Why is that?
Well, if, a lot of reasons, but that's right. So on the one hand, I conclude, and I do think that the researchers who work at Meta, who study the effects of their platform, you know, for the company, the people who do that research are good social scientists. They care about learning the right answers to questions, but they also work at a social media company that has a bottom line, and some research findings are going to want to promote, and some that they're not. The outside academics wanted access to data they could only get if they partnered with Meta to do the work. And so they had to make some compromises, like they wouldn't actually get the raw data. Now, the process they underwent to do the work, I think, was trustworthy, but we should be really skeptical of research where the people whose names are on the studies and the first names, the leaders of the project, never actually got to physically handle the raw data in the way that they do and everything else that they do. So that's one reason. I would say another is that they didn't really get to guide the workflow. Because they didn't get to actually be touching the data, the researchers and staffers at Meta were doing the work. Now, the outside academics would look at all of the code and review it and even could screen share and watch things happen in real time, but they didn't get to actually touch it, and they didn't get to really decide the order of the way that work went because it's not their company, right? And so that also affected which papers came out first. The ones that came out first have shown smaller effects from Facebook on American politics. Ones that are coming later might show bigger effects that might make Meta look worse, but what we're talking about is the big splash, which is the effects are not huge.
Yeah, let's look at that now. At least in the first papers, this big open question is, did the existence and massive size of Facebook and what happened on it, the algorithms that fed us this and not that, did it change us politically in some way? From these earliest studies, what are our provisional answers to those questions?
One study experimentally altered the feeds that different people saw on Facebook. And I think it's important to note that everybody who was a Facebook user who was a part of the study knew it. Mm-hmm. They were asked if they would participate, and they consented to do so. So it wasn't like a lot of other research Facebook has done with academics where it happened and nobody knew that it was happening mm-hmm. while it was happening. This is stuff people knew was happening. And some people had the algorithm change. So instead of getting what Facebook wanted them to see, they saw what's called a reverse chronological feed. In other words, the most recent post of a friend you have on Facebook. And that resulted in more untrustworthy content. It resulted in a decrease in the amount of uncivil and hateful content. So that might be good. It saw an increase in moderate posts from friends who were ideologically mixed, but it didn't affect people's overall issue polarization, so their attitudes about issues. It didn't affect their affective polarization, which is their attitude about the other side in politics, and it actually didn't affect their knowledge either. So the Facebook algorithm experimentally in this study in the U.S. for the 2020 election did not affect those things in a major way.
And how did we measure those things, their views toward people they disagree with, their opinions on issues? Were there surveys along the way?
So in addition to looking at people's behaviors on Facebook, they also did a six-wave panel survey, which means they interviewed the same people six times from before the election season in the summer through after the events of January 6th, after the election was over. And so they have survey research data, and then they also have what Facebook calls classifiers. So Facebook will look at the things you post and the words you use when you post them, and they'll develop an algorithmic way of deciding, do we think you're a liberal or do we think you're a conservative? So they use Facebook's classifiers for ideology, for hateful content, and other kinds of things. But they also use the survey research where they ask the users direct questions about their attitudes and behaviors.
Talking to Mike Wagner from UW-Madison, looking at a big and ongoing research of Facebook, politics on Facebook, some experiments to see how their algorithm affected people's political views. You can join in with your questions about that research at 800-642-1234 and your personal experiences with political views on social media. Do you avoid these things? Do you repost things? Join in at 800-642-1234. Mike, as I understand it, another thing they tested was people's ability to repost articles. And does having that ability versus not having it change political views? Why was that important to measure? What did we find out?
Well, one thing we worry about on social media is that misinformation can get amplified because people reshare it, right? They see it, and then not only do they see it, they share it. They retweet it, they share it, or whatever the term is on the social media platform you're on. And so one thing they did in the studies, they removed reshared content from some people's feeds. And they found that when they removed reshared content, people actually decreased their news knowledge, and it didn't affect polarization. There were other effects that it had as well. There was just, it was less engagement and those sorts of things on Facebook. But it didn't have the positive effect that researchers hypothesized that it might.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Ryan is with us in Amory. Ryan, hi.
Hi. I think the suggestion that Facebook did not affect the polarization is absolutely asinine. The study is already suspect. The company controls all of the data, and none of this is looking at the 2000s when the polarization kicked up. Facebook is wholly responsible, or not wholly, there are other companies too, but yes, Facebook is obviously responsible.
Ryan, thanks for the call. Mike?
This is a common critique of these studies, and so, and I think it's fair to make the critique that the caller is making. Our other things we can say are that we've had polarization in the United States since we've had it. We had a civil war, a full century and a half before we had social media. So there have been deep political divides that had nothing to do with social media. Social media is not required to have it. There's also lots of evidence from other research, not a part of this particular study, that social media does amplify polarization in different kinds of ways, or it amplifies it for particular populations, especially ones that might engage in really dangerous, undemocratic, or violent kinds of behaviors. What the research showed here is that during the election season, Facebook didn't make it worse. Now, maybe looking during a highly partisan election season isn't the time to look for social media's role in polarization. Maybe you'd want to look in the years in between elections to see whether people are getting stewed up. People are really not very likely to decrease their partisanship right before an election. And so we shouldn't maybe expect that to happen.
Ryan, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. One thing I wonder about, Mike, is we hear a lot about negative partisanship. I'm voting against that side as opposed to for my candidate. And also people like partisan identity being a key marker of identity, maybe more than religion or even political views
for many
and
people.
Things like that.
Yeah.
I don't know how, I mean, I'm not a social science researcher. I don't know how I'd measure the impact of Facebook on that. It feels to me like that social media could reinforce that by making a user feel like I am part of this community with these attitudes shared and I'm against that community. I don't know how I'd measure that kind of change. Is that something that's coming in this research?
So there are different ways to measure that kind of change. So one thing you might do is say, here are a lot of different ways people think about who they are, their partisanship, their gender, whether they're a parent, where they live, their job, their likes and dislikes. So there's lots of different things that feed into our identity, their faith, all these things. And you might ask people to rank them. And then you might ask them over and over to rank them. Mm-hmm. And if you see political identity getting closer to the top or closer to the bottom in response to something you're seeing on social media platforms, then you might be able to start to draw a conclusion about how that kind of thing works. Or if you look at things over time, like the caller made a great point in that our current era of polarization really began a couple of decades ago, really 3 decades ago, before Facebook. But once Facebook came on the scene, it really shot into overdrive. And so, you know, if we had been looking in the way that we're looking now back in 2008, maybe the findings would be quite different.
Mike Wagner is with us, professor of journalism and mass communication at UW-Madison. He was an independent auditor, in effect, of a unique study of Facebook and Instagram and their impact on U.S. politics. you can join in at 800-642-1234. What thoughts do you have? What questions do you have about social media algorithms, their influence on politics, how we try to measure that impact, if any? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Mike Wagner, professor of journalism and mass communication at UW-Madison, looking at recent studies reviewing the influence of Facebook's algorithms on political polarization. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your experiences with the political divide on social media. Say, back over the last 5 years ago, did you stop communicating with someone on social media because of the political divide? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Mike, before we go back to our callers, another issue that I know you followed here in Wisconsin as well is the idea of ideological segregation on social media and other media outlets you've tracked here in Wisconsin. What kind of things do we see as we look at this data from Facebook?
Well, we see data that actually matches pretty closely the work we've done in Wisconsin. We found a substantial number of Wisconsin conservatives, about a quarter, tend to consume conservative-leaning news only and or talk to just conservatives about politics and not tend to talk to others. There's a far lower number of liberals who engage in that safe behavior in Wisconsin. And the Facebook study, in terms of social media, found something quite similar. They found that there was a large asymmetry between the information consumed exclusively by individuals on the right, and they found that most misinformation exists within that particular corner of the Facebook ecosystem. And so they tended to find that sources favored by conservative audiences tended to dominate the Facebook news ecosystem, and they were more likely to find misinformation in those sources. Not exclusively or anything like that, but just more likely to find that. Now, the work we did in Wisconsin didn't deal with misinformation from sources. It just dealt with use. But they're similar in that the asymmetry was similar, that there was a larger element of conservative media use purely as compared to liberal media use purely.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234 with Dave on the line in Sussex. Dave, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a consumer of all types of information. I listen to NPR. I listen to conservative talk radio. I seek news stories. I am a critical thinker. And anybody that's a critical thinker can obviously conclude that Facebook and Twitter and these other social media companies absolutely had a large part to play in the polarization in this country based on them deleting information, defined as misinformation. That's basically information that you don't agree with or things that you would prefer people not to say because it hurts your viewpoint and your cause. So you have to take that out of the realm of public forums and squash that information so other people can't hear about it and all that kind of stuff. So absolutely, Facebook was horrible at that, and they should be held liable for a lot of this stuff, people's accounts getting taken off. And
I gotcha, Dave. Thanks a lot for the call. Dave's definition of misinformation may be a different one than you use when you study a social media, Mike?
Maybe so. But I think one thing that is consistent with what I heard Dave saying was that one reason Meta, which is now Facebook's parent company, one reason Meta wanted to do this project and wanted to partner with outside academics to do it was they recognized what a PR hit they took after the 2016 election with the Cambridge Analytica scandal about people's data being used and people being targeted with misinformation in swing states and all of that kind of thing in the 2016 election on Facebook. And they wanted to partner with outside academic researchers, hoping that the public, that journalists and other academics would trust the data more if it was more than just researchers who worked for the social media company saying, here, this is what we found. Mm-hmm. And so that was, I think, behind their goal of trying to organize this effort. But, the common response I think we get in the public is much more consistent with what we've heard in the calls.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Jeff now in Shawano. Jeff, hi.
Hey, thanks again for taking the call. So I just had a question for the professor regarding like the legitimacy of the data. So I just wanted a little bit of clarification there. So first of all, like when you say that the social media companies are working with outside researchers, then, but from what I understood, you say they still control the data that those researchers are getting. Is that correct?
That's correct. And so the Facebook, the Meta controlled the access to the platform data. They controlled access to data where a user of the platform's privacy was at stake, you know, because the, and they have federal regulations and other international ones they have to abide by there. And so usually what happens is the academics who want to partner with the company become a temporary employee of the company, and then that gives them the right to have access to the data. Here, the academics said, we don't want any financial entanglement mm-hmm. with Facebook because that'll impugn our integrity. And so let's instead not have a financial entanglement. And the trade-off is we don't have pure, unrestricted access to the data.
And Jeff, did you want to know more beyond that?
Yeah, can I just ask one? Then can I just make one point really
quick?
Sure. So a lot of the polarization in that, and this is just, again, my opinion. I watch Joe Rogan. I watch Ben Shapiro, right? Like I dance around the spectrum as far as pundits and news media, right? The long form conversation. I feel like a lot of the polarization comes from the lack of the lack of trust in these organizations that we've seen, especially coming out like with Matt Taibbi and the Twitter files, and seeing that there is a certain demographic that is disproportionately represented in the employment of these companies and these big tech companies, and it typically leans to one political party, which I think a lot of us understand would be the left.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. We don't have too much time left, but that there is a perception definitely among conservatives that, the people who work in Silicon Valley are to the left. Is this something you run into, a perception at least, a lot, Mike?
Yeah. I think there's an overwhelming perception that most employees in Silicon Valley are of the left politically. I think there's evidence that most academics are to the left, or at least moderate. There's fewer conservative academics. There's not a balance of that either. And so I think a common critique is of ideology. And the researcher's response to that is, this is why we engage in the scientific process. This is why we have blind peer review of our studies. This is why we had an independent auditor watching us so that who could comment on it. Those are the common perceptions that we hear about how Silicon Valley works, about how the academy works, about how the news media works. And so these are common critiques.
Thanks a lot for that call. Talking to Mike Wagner about new research on Facebook's influence or lack of say about political polarization. As we've mentioned a couple times, Mike, these are just the first couple studies coming out of this bigger project. What so far to you stands out as a big unanswered question that is hopefully answerable?
That's a great question. I think it would be great to know how long different effects last. And so if polarization gets worse or stays the same, is that something that lasts for a long time, or does it just last around election day? How long do these things last, and how does the duration of an effect influence your subsequent behavior and your subsequent attitudes?
One thing, a concern for a while, was that Facebook rewarded engagement.
Yes.
Engagement could be 40 people having a fun conversation about a topic, or it could be two people making 20 comments each arguing with each other. There was a reward system for controversial topic that generated heated and not always productive debate. Is that something that is part of the story here?
Yeah, that is something that the researchers found a little bit of. They did find regarding the reverse chronological feed, it decreased the amount of uncivil and hateful content on Facebook. Mm-hmm. So the algorithm is kicking up stuff that's more emotional.
Right.
And so when they did away with that, we saw less of it. So there's definitely something that this study is consistent with.
Mike, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Mike Wagner, professor in UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Mike had a special role as an auditor of sorts on a series of studies reviewing Facebook's influence on political polarization. Still time for you to share your thoughts on this, and this could be fodder for a future show. Have you seen politics on social media change over the years as some of these companies have changed their algorithms, maybe in some cases responding to public criticism. Do you think they've done a good job, or do you still see a lot of stuff you don't want to see? And have you, as I asked earlier, stopped communicating with somebody on social media because of political differences? You can do an old-fashioned social media. You could email us. You could email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. And let us know what you are seeing online. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, an estimated 500,000 people deal with diabetes here in Wisconsin. Join Kate with some diabetes experts, get the latest on prevention and the latest treatments and access to those treatments, and join the conversation yourself if you have a story. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. The moon will hit our eye like a big pizza pie, not just once, but twice this month. That's a supermoon. As reported by NPR, a supermoon is when a full moon lines up with the moon's closest point to Earth in its orbit. That's going to make it look a little bigger and a little brighter. It happens tonight and again on August 30th. Tonight should be a good moon watching night. I did a quick weather survey. Most of the states should just be partly cloudy, except in the north, maybe a little rain, maybe mostly cloudy. Moonrise starts around 8:45 tonight in the eastern part of the state, 9:15 in the western part. Should look extra big on the horizon. I always like that, thanks to an optical illusion. If you get good pictures, I want to see them. Email ideas@WPR.org. Lunar news you can use. This is Central Time.